You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in-depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso and espresso and cream flavors. I had one this morning before I came into the studio, and let me tell you, it gave me just the boost I needed to get my day going. Plus, it tastes so delicious, I'd drink it anyway. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. It could be said that my guest today has had 2 of the most consequential careers of any American public servant in the past 50 years. Leon Panetta's first career, beginning as an Army intelligence officer and including a distinguished run as one of Congress's most powerful and respected members, culminated in his transformational role as Clinton's budget czar and White House chief of staff. He then retired to establish the Panetta Institute with his wife of 50 years, Sylvia, to serve on the Iraq Study Group and to protect his beloved California coastline. But in 2009, he accepted what many said was a thankless task, returning to public office as the director of the CIA, taking it from a state of turmoil after the controversial torture debates and moving it back to the vital center of America's war against al-Qaeda, including the campaign that led to the killing of Osama bin Laden. And then, in the wake of bin Laden's death, Panetta became the U.S. Secretary of Defense, inheriting 2 troubled wars in a time of austerity and painful choices. But Leon Panetta knows better than most that oftentimes worthy fights demand difficult decisions. Because as he explains to me today, if you don't govern through leadership, you end up governing through crisis. During a wide-ranging conversation at the Ronald Reagan National Defense Forum, Leon Panetta recalls growing up in Monterey, California, as the first generation of Italian immigrants washing dishes in his parents' restaurant as a kid, and warns that the Trump administration's harsh immigration policies could mean fewer immigrant success stories like his own. He reveals how he started out his political career as a Republican until President Richard Nixon fired him for daring to enforce civil rights laws. He shares some early lessons in political civility and bipartisanship from his mentor, Senator Thomas Kuchel, and how those lessons served him well when he attempted to rein in the federal budget as President Bill Clinton's director of the Office of Management and Budget. Then he discusses stepping in as Clinton's chief of staff during a particularly chaotic time in his presidency, how his early military training helped him get the Clinton White House in shape, and some words of advice that he recently shared with his old Pentagon colleague and President Trump's outgoing chief of staff, John Kelly. Panetta admits to his surprise when years later President Obama tapped him for director of the CIA, opens up about what went through his mind as he watched the bin Laden raid go down, and says that Obama's failure to enforce his own red line on Syria's chemical weapons may have emboldened Russian President Vladimir Putin, not just in Syria, but also in Crimea, and perhaps even in his interference in the 2016 election. All that and more when I talk to Leon Panetta, coming up in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
Leon Panetta served as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 2009 to 2011 and as Secretary of Defense from 2011 to 2013. Prior to that, he was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for more than 15 years and the director of the Office of Management and Budget and White House Chief of Staff to President Bill Clinton. Nowadays, he spends his time encouraging young people to go into public service through the Panetta Institute for Public Policy, which he founded with his wife, Sylvia. Leon Panetta, thanks for sitting down with me.
Good to be with you.
I want to begin at the beginning here and talk about where you were raised in Monterey and your parents, who were first-generation immigrants from Italy, worked hard at the restaurant in Monterey, California, and you were raised sort of by your grandfather or no-no. I think I have that right. Is that what you called him?
No-no. Yeah.
Tell us a little about your own immigrant experience.
Well, I've often said that I've really had the chance to live the American dream. As the son of Italian immigrants. My parents came here in the early 30s, like millions of others, with very little language ability and very little money and very few skills. My father managed to make it to Monterey, California, and open a restaurant in downtown Monterey during the war years. And my earliest recollections were washing glasses in the back of that restaurant as I was just a young boy. My parents, I have often said, my parents believed in child labor when I was a kid. And then sold the restaurant, bought a farm in Carmel Valley, and worked out there as well. But my parents, I remember asking my dad, why did you come all of that distance to come to America? You obviously came from a poor area in Italy, but they had the comfort of family. They had friends. Why would you leave all of that to come to this country? And my dad said something that I've never forgotten, which was that my mother and he really believed they could give their children a better life in this country. And that is the American dream. Because of their support and because of the opportunity that this country provided them and my brother and I think we were able to live the American dream.
You're a living example of it, to go from washing dishes in mom and dad's restaurant all the way to all the big things that I just described in the intro. Given all that's happening now on the immigration front, do you worry that immigrant success stories like your family's may be fewer and far between in the years to come?
I do worry about it because I really do believe that America is a land of immigrants. And that includes our forefathers. It includes, generations of immigrants who came to this country over our 200 years, who now have become a part of the fabric of American society. And it's what the Statue of Liberty, I think, really represented, which is a United States and America that welcomed people to our shores. And that certainly was true for my parents. I think it's been true for other immigrants. And frankly, it is the strength of America. We're a diverse society. That's mm-hmm. the reality of America. I think we ought to be trying to do everything we can, obviously, to continue to encourage those that want to come to this country. But one of the problems we really have is an immigration system that is broken and that for a number of reasons is not working the way it should. And it's creating this tremendous controversy that we now have with regards to immigration. All of that needs to be fixed.
It might surprise some people that your career in politics began as a promising young Republican. In fact, you served in the Nixon administration as the director of the Office of Civil Rights until you got on Nixon's bad side for, heaven forbid, actually daring to try and enforce civil rights. You weren't fired and you didn't resign, so how exactly would you describe your exit?
You're right. I started as a Republican in California. California in those days, we really had what I call the legacy of Hiram Johnson, who was a Republican, mm-hmm. but he was also a progressive in many areas. And Earl Warren followed in the legacy of Hiram Johnson. And a guy named Tom Kuchel, who was a senator from California, also represented that same kind of legacy. And I went back to Washington. My first job in Washington was working as a legislative assistant to Tom Kuchel. And at the time, he was very much as a Republican, and that was true for Everett Dirksen, who was the minority leader. They were working on civil rights legislation. And that is, I was, as a legislative assistant, was very much involved in working on civil rights legislation. And that's how I ultimately got the job as director of the Office for Civil Rights in the Nixon administration. And the problem was that President Nixon had made a deal, the so-called Southern Strategy, which was that he would lighten up on enforcement on civil rights in order to get the support of Strom Thurmond and other Southern Republicans. And so there was a great deal of pressure not to enforce the law the way it should be. And I kind of made the fundamental decision that I was sworn to uphold the law and continue to enforce the law. And I knew that it was, you know, that I was, you know, kind of a target for those that thought that, you know, we should lighten up on civil rights enforcement. But I continued to do my job, and the Secretary of HEW encouraged me to continue to do that. I'll just tell you the story very briefly. I woke up one morning and the paper, I think it was the Post, Washington Post, said that was announcing that I had resigned. And I had. So I remember going to the secretary and saying, look, there's this story that I've resigned, but it's, you know, as you know, it's not true. And he said, no, no, deny it. You know, just basically say it's not true. And so I did. But then, you know,
what is the old saying? If you read it in the papers, it must be true.
That's right.
And you found it out the hard way, I guess.
I did. What happened was that Ron Ziegler, who was the press secretary to President Nixon, had one of his press briefings and was asked about whether or not I had resigned. And he confirmed it. He said, yeah, he has resigned. So when I saw that happen, then I decided that I would, in order to avoid embarrassment of the secretary, go ahead and submit my resignation. But that was the story of how it came to an end.
Yeah, that's a hard lesson to learn. Now, you switched, I think, a year after that to a Democrat. How much did that play into your decision?
You know, it was more the larger changes that were occurring in the Republican Party, because in the Republican Party that I knew was the party of Lincoln, the party that supported civil rights. And then it was beginning to change at that point. And I remember the Vice President Spiro Agnew actually campaigning against some moderate Republicans, Goodell from New York State. He actually campaigned against a moderate Republican. And I knew that it was going to be really tough to be able to stay a Republican and not get knives put in my back. So at that point, I decided that I would become a Democrat. And it was a much larger tent. It really gave me a sense that, you know, I was now true to my own beliefs. And I could continue to believe what I thought was right, particularly when it came to civil rights.
And as a congressman, you were kind of known for following in the footsteps of Kuchel and Javits and Dirksen because you crafted bipartisan legislation that allowed for more of the parties concerned to kind of walk away feeling like they had a win and had done something good for the country. What happened to that? What happened to the spirit of cooperation and civility? When did it start to go sour?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people are asking that question because they see the dysfunction in Washington. I've often said that I've seen Washington at its best and Washington at its worst. And I saw Washington work. I saw Republicans and Democrats working together to deal with legislation. Of course, they had their political differences, but they believed that it was important to work together on issues that were confronting the country. And that's the way I was raised, you know, working in the Congress. And when I got elected as a member of Congress, Tip O'Neill was the speaker, Democrat's Democrat. But Bob Michael was the minority leader from Illinois. And again, they had their differences, but they worked together. And they really felt that if the president needed something to be done for the country, that Democrats and Republicans should work together. And that's the way our process was designed, to be able to find consensus and compromise and work together on issues. That's why people elect you. I've also seen Washington at its worst, and it's become very divided. It's become very partisan. There are a lot of reasons that contribute to that divisiveness in Washington. But the problem is now, as a result of that severe partisanship, it's been very difficult for Republicans and Democrats to really work together the way they should. And I think the country pays a price for that, because we talked about immigration. We are not getting immigration reform because they can't find a solution. We're not getting funding for infrastructure. We're not dealing with the budget and the terrible debt that's facing this country. There are a huge number of issues that need to be dealt with that Congress, for whatever reason, is unable to address. Mm. And I think the country, as a result of that, is paying a price.
Yeah, and you know a thing or two about the budget because you served as the chairman of the House Budget Committee and then as the head of the Office of Management and Budget under President Clinton. In fact, you led the way toward a balanced budget in 1998. When you look at the ballooning deficit and the freewheeling spending under, of all people, President Donald Trump, do you wonder what the hell happened to all these self-proclaimed Republican budget hawks that you had to deal with back in the day?
Well, it is a tremendous concern. We went through this, as you've pointed out. As a matter of fact, President Bush, who just passed away, I really give him a tremendous amount of credit for his willingness to face this issue. And I remember Republicans and Democrats coming together at Andrews Air Force Base, and we sat down and developed a budget agreement that dealt with all areas. We got savings out of entitlements. We got savings out of discretionary spending, defense, and we raised taxes. Tough decisions, but it was the right thing to do. And we did the same thing in the Clinton administration with President Clinton's first budget. And as a result of that, we did balance the budget. It was tough decisions, but it was the right thing to do for the country. Now we find ourselves $20 trillion in debt. We now have an annual deficit that is approaching $1 trillion. It is going to seriously impact our economy, if it hasn't already, with interest rates. We're going to find that the resources we need in order to deal whatever our priorities are not going to be there. We're here at a defense forum. People are talking about spending a lot more money for defense. But the problem is that this huge debt we're running will erode that ability to have those resources for the future. And the problem now is that neither Republicans or Democrats or this president is willing to face the tough decisions that have to be made if we're going to discipline the budget. And I worry that the only way it will force both Republicans and Democrats to face this issue is if we have a crisis.
Yeah, I think that you're sort of famous for saying that you're a big believer in leadership through, I'm trying to think, how do you say it? Now
I'm
forgetting the quote.
In our democracy, we either lead by leadership or by crisis.
That's right.
And if leadership is there and willing to take the risks associated with leadership, then we can avoid crisis.
Yeah.
But if there's no leadership and nobody wants to deal with these tough issues, then we will govern by crisis.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is what's happening today.
Yeah, sort of the political version of an ounce of prevention's worth a pound of cure, huh?
You got it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Leon Panetta when we come back in just a minute. This episode of Kick-Ass News is sponsored by the audiobook edition of Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal, written and read by Senator Ben Sasse. Something is wrong in America, and we all know it. In this intimate and urgent assessment of our country, best-selling author and U.S. Senator Ben Sasse argues that the crisis isn't really about politics at all. It's about loneliness and the collapse of community. If you listened to my recent interview with Senator Ben Sasse, then you already heard me rave about them. This is a timely and relevant audiobook, and you can hear this compelling audiobook in the author's own voice. Take it with you in the car or around the house. Listen to an excerpt and buy the audiobook now by visiting macmillanaudio.com/them. That's macmillanaudio.com/them. These days, it's harder than ever to have a healthy work-life balance. Our phones, our social media, and myriad other technology ensure that you can never be 100% focused on one or the other. But if you're wondering where you can get some answers about the workplace, then I want to introduce you to a new podcast. From Wondery, the network behind Business Wars and Dirty John, comes Safe for Work, a podcast about helping you find balance and happiness in your career and your life. After all, many of us spend more time with our coworkers and clients than with our friends and family. Hosts Liz Dolan and Rico Gagliano give advice on everything from how to avoid burnout to how to fake an illness when you're calling in sick. They also talk to experts about those moments at the office that can challenge the best of us, negotiating raises, knowing when it's time to move on, or dealing with that annoying office mate who has no boundaries. Every episode is filled with helpful career advice that's lively and fun, just like your work life should be. So go subscribe to Safe for Work on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. And now, back to the podcast. After you served as director of OMB, President Clinton asked you to be his chief of staff. And I want to read a quote by author Nigel Hamilton, who praised you and said, I'm sure you've heard this before, in Leon Panetta, Clinton got the enforcer he deserved. What did you see as your first priority coming in as the enforcer?
Well, you know, it was, I had served, as you pointed out, as director of the Office of Management and Budget. We passed the budget. I was very proud of that. The president was very appreciative of that. It was a centerpiece, really, for his administration. And then I think it was Al Gore, was vice president, approached me and said, you know, I think the president would like to have you as chief of staff. And I said, you know, I think I serve him better as director of OMB. And he said, yeah, I know, but they really want you to do this. So one day I got an invitation to go up to Camp David. And so Al Gore took me up on his helicopter. And I got up to Camp David, walked into the president's cabin, and there was President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and Tipper Gore, and myself. I knew immediately I was in trouble at that point. The president said, I'd like you to become chief of staff. I said, you know, Mr. President, I'm serving you as OMB director. I really think I'm doing a good job there. I think I'm more valuable to you in that job. And the president said something I'll never forget. He said, you know, Leon, you could be the greatest OMB director in the history of the country, but if the White House has fallen apart, nobody's going to remember you. I never forgot that.
And I said, all right,
the president asked you. And I took the job. And what I found was that there was just a total lack of discipline in the way the White House operated. A lot of people went to meetings. There were no clear lines of supervision. So falling back on my Army experience, one of the first things I had to do was to develop a chart that laid out the chain of command. Chief of staff, I had deputy chiefs of staff, who was responsible to them, so that there was a disciplined operation. I controlled access to the Oval Office to make sure that people just didn't wander into the Oval Office. I developed a policy-making mechanism to provide the president with the best advice on policy issues. And it was not easy because it involved a great deal of discipline in what had been an undisciplined operation. But the president supported that. I mean, that's important. I'm often asked, you know, John Kelly, who's an old friend, who's now chief of staff.
Yeah, he served President Trump. When you were Secretary of Defense,
yeah,
right?
He called me when he became chief of staff and said, what do I do? And I kind of went through everything I'd done as chief of staff to President Clinton. But in the end, I said, look, I had a president who was willing to accept that discipline because he knew that it was important for his operation. I said, I think you're dealing with someone who's much tougher to accept that kind of discipline. And I think I was right.
Yeah, I think that's borne out, I'd say, over the past couple of years. Now, it's funny when you describe your surprise and resistance when he wanted you to be his chief of staff, because it reminds me of something that happened just a few years later. Here you are, you have a comfortable life in the private sector, you founded the Panetta Institute, and all of a sudden you get tapped to be CIA director. Were you surprised to get that call? What did you think?
I was. I was not surprised that I think it was Rahm Emanuel who called. He was the chief of staff designate for the president. Well, he had been appointed to be chief of staff to President Obama, and Rahm called and was talking and said, you know, we're thinking of you to be director of the CIA, and I said, have you got the right person?
Wrong number.
Yeah, because, you know, I was an intelligence officer in the military, but a lot of my work, as we talked about, it was done on budget, and I also was involved in ocean issues. He said, no, he said, we need to restore the credibility of the CIA, and I think the president wants you to do that. And I just thought this is not going to happen. And within a few weeks, the president called me, President-elect Obama called me, and asked me to become director of the CIA. You know, like a lot of my jobs throughout government, I looked at it as a real challenge. The CIA had not found bin Laden. Mm-hmm. We were fighting the war against al-Qaeda, the 9/11 war.
Mm-hmm. And public relations problems as well, which was probably why they were attracted to something of an intelligence outsider like yourself.
I think CIA had become a political football in the Congress, mm-hmm. like a lot of other issues. And I think the fact that I'd had that experience in the Congress and also experience with other jobs was what made them decide to appoint me. And I really found the CIA, which I'd worked with CIA types on briefings for the president, but this was the first time I actually went out to Langley and met the people there and found them to be really not Republicans or Democrats, but just good Americans trying to do a very tough job. And I was really honored to be in that position.
When you were head of CIA, I have to think back, but I'm pretty sure that President Obama never showed up at Langley and gave a campaign speech or talked about his inauguration crowd size. What do you make of the relationship or perhaps lack of a relationship between this president and the CIA? Has that trust been broken and can it be repaired?
Well, I was really concerned about how this president began by criticizing the CIA, and then goes out to the CIA and gives a political speech, and then basically says he didn't want to receive intelligence briefings, for goodness sakes. And I think that had to hurt the morale of intelligence officers, because they put their lives on the line for a lot of this information. And to have a president who, was kind of rejecting them out of hand cannot be easy. I think what helped is that Mike Pompeo became the director. The president seemed to have a lot of confidence in him, and I think gradually it did restore the confidence of the president with regards to intelligence. Although the president continues to raise questions mm-hmm. about yeah. The conclusions that the CIA presents, and I think that continues to hurt not only the morale at the CIA, but I also think that it hurts the president because if he doesn't accept that kind of intelligence in order to make the decisions he has to make, that's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, he's refusing help from people who just want to help him do a better job.
Yeah, I mean,
it's kind of absurd.
These are people yeah. that are saying to the president, don't walk out into that grenade mm-hmm. field.
Yeah. yeah.
And if the president says, well, I just don't believe it's a grenade field.
What can you do?
You know what's going to happen. Yeah. And that's what's yeah. scary.
Now, the key achievement during your time as director of the CIA was, of course, catching bin Laden, or killing bin Laden.
Yeah.
There's this famous photo of you and President Obama, Secretary Clinton, Bob Gates in, I don't know, either the Situation Room or the PIOC, as you're watching the bin Laden raid go down. You can cut the tension with a knife, and there's almost a visible gasp from Secretary Clinton. Do you remember what you were reacting to in that photo and what was going through your mind?
Well, I can tell you exactly what that was about. Just to correct the record, I was not at the White House in that picture because I was at the CIA running the operation.
Funny how we create false memories, isn't it?
So we were running the operation.
You were there in spirit. Let's say that.
Well, what we were doing is we were feeding some of what we were seeing to the White House and keeping them informed of what was happening in the operation.
Okay.
But we were actually, I was running the operation out of the CIA, and I was in touch with Bill McCraven, who was the Special Forces Director, who was in charge of the SEALs that were actually conducting the operation. There were two teams of SEALs that had to go 150 miles into Pakistan at night and go after this compound where we thought bin Laden was located. We had practiced this a great deal. We had really worked it through. We were now following those helicopters going into Pakistan, and we were feeding this to the people at the White House. When those helicopters got over the compound, because it had been a hot day that day in Abbottabad, which is where the compound was located, the heat from the ground came up and stalled one of the helicopters.
Right.
And thank God we had a great officer who was a pilot, an old timer, who set that helicopter down. And it was that moment when the helicopter went down with its tail up on the wall of the compound that I think is when that picture was taken in the White House.
What would that picture of you have shown at Langley?
It would have been similar, although at that point I immediately was talking to Bill McCraven and saying, what the hell is going on? Because you had this scene of, oh, my God, you know, something's going terribly wrong here. Bill McCraven didn't miss a beat. He said, we're going to go on with the operation. We're going to breach the walls. They initially were going to rappel down into the compound. They couldn't do that. They had to actually breach through the walls. He said, we're going to continue to do that. I've got some backup helicopters coming in. This mission is going forward. I said, God bless you. Let's do it. And he did. We picked up some sound of gunfire, which meant that they were running into some opposition. And then there was 20 minutes of silence, probably the longest 20 minutes in my life.
I'll bet.
And at the end of that 20 minutes, I heard Bill McCraven say, I think we have a Geronimo, which was the code word for getting bin Laden. And we all kind of held our breath. And within a few minutes, he came back and said, we have a Geronimo. And wow. We knew that that the mission had been successful. And they had the backup helicopters. They got the body, put it on one of those helicopters, took off with all of the SEALs, plus the dog that was with them, and were able to return with nobody having been lost in that mission. It was a great mission by a lot of brave people.
Boy, that's when you say it's Miller time, isn't it?
You got it. I mean, when they finally landed in Afghanistan is when we finally were able to express a sigh of relief.
Yeah. I know that you said that it was a mistake that President Obama failed to enforce his own red line on chemical weapons in Syria. What kind of message do you think that sent? And specifically, do you think that you could even draw a line between that incident and a more emboldened Vladimir Putin in not just Syria, Ukraine, but even perhaps the 2016 election?
I don't think there's any question that the reason Putin is doing what he's doing, his aggressiveness in the Ukraine, in the Crimea, in Syria, attacking our election process, is based on the fact that he senses weakness on the part of the United States. And when a president of the United States gives his word that if there is a chemical attack, we're going to take action. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, whether you should do that can be subject to question. But once you do that, once you draw that red line, you've got to stand by it. And I thought not to do that sent exactly the wrong message. And I think that continues. I mean, I think when President Trump doesn't stand up to Putin, particularly with regards to what he's doing in the Ukraine, as well as elsewhere, that sends a message of weakness. And if you're going to deal with bullies in the world, and Putin is a bully, you can only deal with a bully through strength and through being very tough, which isn't to say, you know, if you're tough and you tell him where the lines are that he can't cross, I think you can negotiate. Mm-hmm. But if you don't draw those lines, then you put yourself and the world at a tremendous disadvantage.
And these are the kind of ideas you're trying to drive home with the young people at the Panetta Institute for Public Policy. Where can people go to find out more or even donate?
It's the Panetta Institute, and it's info@panettainstitute.org.
Perfect. Go check it out, folks.
We would really appreciate your support for these young kids who are our future investment in the security of our country.
Absolutely. And speaking of future investments in the country, I just want to congratulate you on your son, Congressman Jimmy, getting reelected a month ago or so, or a few
Thank
weeks
you.
Ago,
we were,
I guess.
Yeah, my wife and I were very proud of that. He took my old seat in the Congress, he's now back there. Yeah. We're very proud of what he's doing. And it's interesting to kind of relive those moments through him because he's right on the front lines.
Well, you're obviously a proud dad, Secretary Panetta. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with
me. Nice to be with you. Great.
Thanks again to Leon Panetta for coming on the podcast. And I also want to give a special thanks to the Reagan National Defense Forum and the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum for hosting our interview. Learn more about the Panetta Institute for Public Policy at panettainstitute.org. How can you live a better life when you're working so much? The new Wondery podcast called Safe for Work is all about helping you find balance and happiness in your work life. Get advice on everything from how to avoid burnout on the job to how to fake an illness when you're calling in sick. Go subscribe to Safe for Work on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.